The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder how can so many Christians call themselves compassionate, but not embrace free health care? Well, for one thing, it isn't free. It isn't even cheap. That's a pretty big elephant in the room. My health care premiums have gone up twice since Obamacare was passed. Why? Well, the company, the health care provider, will explain it to you. All the new government regulations stifle their private sector, and to stay in business, they raise their premiums. But the main objection from Christians, and I should say, this objection is not from all Christians. I meet many Bible-believing Christians who vehemently disagree with me regarding health care, regarding all kinds of political things. But for the Christians who would say they take a politically conservative position, for the most part, they do have an objection to this government-mandated health care. And quite frankly, our concern is that freedom is being eradicated. Freedom is also an important quality. We can't refuse to examine two sides of an issue out of fear that somebody will accuse us of lacking compassion. We still have to use the brains God gave us. And today, I will be challenging everybody, be they conservative, be they liberal, be they Christian, be they atheist, be they agnostic, be they of another religion, I will be challenging everybody to use the brains God gave them when examining this current healthcare law and this current president. Welcome to our program, the theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. It's very good to be back with you. I've been away the past 2 weeks. Last week, of course, we aired our annual Easter rebroadcast, The Best of the Bob Siegel Show. The week before, I was gone because I attended a writer's conference up in beautiful Mount Hermon. That's in the Santa Cruz Mountains, the outskirts of the Bay Area. I know many of you were praying for me because a lot of you emailed me and told me, thank you so much for your prayers. I want you to know your prayers were answered. God did amazing things, and some very significant doors did open up. Also, a special thanks to Dana Wright and Matt Simone for filling in that week. They did a tremendous job. I heard the recording of the program when I got back in town. I was very impressed. If you missed that show, I urge you to go to my website, and you can find all kinds of shows on my website. But if you want the most recent ones, it's very easy. Just go to the front page of the website, bobsiegel.net. Look in the upper right-hand corner where you will always see listed the past 6 shows, and download this program where Dana interviews Matt on the subject of capital punishment regarding Christians. Now, today, we have a special guest coming up a little bit later in the program, Henry Bernacki, a travel writer who once had the privilege of interviewing Mother Teresa. In fact, he interviewed her during her last days. I know you won't want to miss this, but I'll tell you what I didn't miss. I did not miss April Fool's Day. Boy, I'm telling you, though, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. 2 weeks ago, my online column, Forbidden Table Talk, my online column featured an April Fool's story, and it was identified as April Fool's in the end, but I wrote it as if it was really happening, about a very special press conference where President Obama takes personal responsibility for his actions. All kinds of people wrote me and told me they were fooled. It was entitled in the headline, President Shocks Reporters. Okay, that was April Fool's. Well, one day after the column was published, on April the 2nd, Obama really did shock reporters. And it wasn't an April Fool's gag. He really did shock reporters with statements about our Supreme Court. In case you've been taking a vacation from the news, nine chief justices are presently in isolated discussion weighing the constitutionality of Obamacare. At stake is the very specific question of a federal government's power. Can civil leaders command citizens to purchase something they don't want? Is personal freedom in jeopardy despite fancy merchandising slogans such as affordable health care or endorsements from Nancy Pelosi saying we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it? Yeah, that's fun. Pass it first, then we'll find out what's in it. You know, a lot of people will agree that a Tootsie Roll pop always sounds delicious. But some of us prefer to decide for ourselves whether or not to bite into its crunchy outside before discovering the chewy center. And so, our Supreme Court justices are doing some chewing of their own in the form of deliberations which may end by striking some or even all of Obama's proud signature accomplishment. But Obama doesn't seem to think that anyone, even a judge, should ever have cause to disagree with his wise statement. Listen to his statement about his legislation. I'm going to read it carefully. Now, notice that he's actually saying two different things at the same time. Here's Obama. Ultimately, I'm confident that the Supreme Court will not take what would be an unprecedented, extraordinary step. See, he's saying he's confident that they're not going to do what he doesn't want them to do, but then he talks about how unprecedented and extraordinary of a step it would be if they do it. So he's kind of having it both ways. Like, oh, I know they won't do it, but boy, if they do it, that would be pretty bad, wouldn't it? I'm confident the Supreme Court will not take what would be an unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of a democratically elected Congress. And I just remind conservative commentators that for years, what we've heard is the biggest problem of the bench was judicial activism. Of course, Obama never seemed concerned about that judicial activism. But what he's saying now is, well, if they overturn something I do, that'll be judicial activism. So you conservatives, you really ought to be on my side. So he's quoting the conservatives here. That would be a problem on the bench, judicial activism or a lack of judicial restraint, he says, as opposed to an unelected group of people, or he says coming from the Supreme Court, which he calls an unelected group of people who would somehow overturn a duly constituted and passed law. Well, this is a good example, Obama says, and I'm pretty confident that this court will recognize that and not take that step. So he's saying, I'm sure they're not going to do this, but boy, if they do, it's almost like he's warning the people, warning the court, trying to get the court to stick out their fingers to the wind and listen to a public opinion poll. Well, those were Obama's initial words. As you know, much has happened since then, including a request for clarification from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, to reassurances from Attorney General Eric Holder, to White House Press Secretary Jay Carney offering reporters some Virgil gymnastics that would make Shakespeare blush. And in the midst of this back and forth wind toss drama, our president's opinion has been walked back, re-explained, parsed, sliced, diced, stirred, stretched, and de-stenched so that all Americans can sleep better at night, finally reassured once and for all as to what he truly meant to say. Well, I'll go out on a limb and guess that what Obama said the first time was what he actually meant. The phenomenon of original intent applies to all words, not merely our Constitution. But then even statement one demonstrated strategic ambiguity. It was a stroke of genius. As politically savvy as they come, a win-win for Obama no matter what happens. Step right up. See President Obama take two positions at the same time. If the Supreme Court upholds his health care law, well, of course, he was confident that they would. He knew it all the time. After all, judicial review is a time-honored American tradition going all the way back to the landmark Marbury versus Madison case of 1804. Our respected justices affirmed his health care mandate so clearly, it may as well have been a neon light smack in the middle of our Constitution's Commerce Clause. On the other hand, if they don't uphold this law, well, Obama has a new election talking point to join other classic gems such as the rich must pay their fair share, Republicans are the party of no, and 7,000 recitations of I Got Osama Bin Laden. Now our president candidate can also portray himself as the man who stands for democracy rather than judicial activism. Interestingly enough, Obama embraced what many would call a road to judicial activism when his Justice Department filed a lawsuit against an Arizona immigration law, and all the Arizona immigration law did was enforce the federal immigration law. And how about judicial activism overturning California's marriage law, put in force by Democracy to the tune of some 60 million voters, more than 60 million voters? When his press secretary was asked for a reaction, Carney, as usual, spoke as clearly as Obama himself. See if you can make sense of this gobbledygook. They asked him, well, what does Obama think about the fact that a court overturned the will of the California people? He says, well, I'm not going to comment on litigation, particularly as here where we are not party to it, but the president's positions on these issues writ large are well known, and he's long opposed divisive and discriminatory efforts to deny right and benefits to same-sex couples. Huh? What's that? What the heck is he talking? It's like the party of the first part here before bequeathed to the party of the second part. This is gobbledygook. This is politics. Now, that's not to say Obama has no track record at all for embracing state rights. He does. He does. When running for office in 2008, Obama had an interesting exchange, an on-air interview with Pastor Rick Warren regarding same-sex marriage. Now, we could play this for you, but I'm going to read it to you so that you can really think about this. I'm going to read it off of the script, off the transcript. Warren, define marriage. Obama, I believe that marriage is the union between a man and a woman. Now, for me as a Christian, yes, he does repeat himself that many times. For me as a Christian, it is also a sacred union. God's in the mix, but then Warren interjects. Warren says, would you support a constitutional amendment with that definition? Obama, no, I would not. Warren, why not? Obama, because historically, we have not defined marriage in our Constitution. It's been a matter of state law. Okay, so with Rick Warren, Obama embraced the idea of matters being left to the states. That's great. That's wonderful. It's fantastic. Only one problem. When asked that same year in an MTV interview his opinion of Prop 8, which attempted to make marriage a state issue, Obama said he was against it. Okay. Oh, well, it's all so clear now. Here, your old pal Bob's going to explain it to you. This is Obama's clear position. Obama believes marriage is a union between a man and a woman, but he doesn't think we need a federal law stating as much because state laws are sufficient, even though in the case of one of these state laws called California's law, he disagrees that they should have such a law, and when their law is overturned by the courts, his press secretary can offer no decipherable comment. Yes, state rights are a tricky, delicate thing for this president. Over half our states filed suits against government-mandated health care, leading to current Supreme Court deliberations. I guarantee you, Obama will not be crying for these states if his health care law is upheld. But just in case health care is not upheld by the court, he expresses a preemptive strike concern over what a quote-unquote unelected group of people might somehow overturn. Actually, Supreme Court justices do get confirmed by Congress, even though Obama calls them unelected. Maybe he was confusing these justices for some of his czars. In any event, Obama has his bases covered for June. He will offer a convincing speech against judicial activism should his prized law be sent down the laundry chute. We'll be reminded it was conservative extremists who did so. Justices appointed by Republican presidents. We will not hear Obama elaborate on the constructionist philosophy openly embraced by certain conservative justices who seek to find original intent. Why? So that the Constitution being enforced is the same one our forefathers actually wrote. Of course, if the decision goes Obama's way, it is doubtful that he'll be expressing concern about liberal justices, two of which, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, he nominated himself. Elena Kagan's bias doesn't seem to keep Obama up at nights, even though she helped to sell the very healthcare law in question, yet she refuses to recuse herself from the case. Now, Kagan certainly holds no monopoly on bias. It comes in many forms. For example, Sonia Sotomayor, in her 2001 law school speech at Berkeley, said, "I would hope that a wise Latina woman, with the richness of her experiences, would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life." Yeah, it sure makes a lot of sense. Exactly how does race, gender, or both arrive at a better conclusion when supposedly the task of a justice is to read what the Constitution says, apply it to a current law in question, and then enforce our ruling document? Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg might want to take a crack at that question, a third liberal justice, a Clinton appointee. In fact, we may have already heard her answer in an interview in Egypt, where she boldly said, "I would not look to the United States Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. Sweet. And so, as our Supreme Court continues deliberating, our liberal and conservative Supreme Court justice deliberating, the Obama campaign machine prepares to offer either possible verdict as a reason to grant him a second term. Rallying cry A, vote for our vindicated president who gave you health care. Or rallying cry B, vote to vindicate our president who gave you health care until those mean and nasty conservatives swiped it away as easily as a criminal steals candy from a baby. Either strategy will do. The only important word, after all, is vote."
This is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. If you'd like to weigh in on any of this, of course, you can always call us, but a lot of people reaching us on the internet these days, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. And of course, who would we be if we did not step into the 21st century? You can reach us through Facebook. You can reach us through Twitter. In fact, here are a few Facebook comments, starting with some comments on a radio show I did a few weeks ago. As far as live shows go, it wasn't that long ago, but since I haven't been here a couple of weeks, it seems long ago now, I did a show about worry, overcoming worry, how God will help us in our prayers to overcome worry. Deb on Facebook says, "Another great show, Bob. Thanks. I always appreciate your thought-provoking insights and your plain truth speaking." Well, thank you, Deb. Your comments are always very encouraging. And Robert on Facebook, regarding that same show, says, "One thing I don't have to worry about is where I spend my eternity. My God has made that clear." Well, he certainly has, Robert, if we've given our lives to Jesus Christ. Unfortunately, we nutty human beings still find stuff to worry about, even when eternity is secure. Now, as for any of listeners who are not Christians, and I know I have many listeners who do not share my Christian convictions, I am delighted that you follow this program. I mean that. Please know that what Jesus gave to Robert, what Jesus gives to me by way of a personal relationship, he offers to you as well. It's not some kind of exclusive club. There are many articles on my website, bobsiegel.net, explaining how to have this relationship, or send me a direct email or give us a call. Regarding Obama and the Supreme Court, discussed in today's monologue and in this week's online column, Forbidden Table Talk, Russ on Facebook says, "If a person can be fined for actually doing nothing, for inactivity or non-participation, then the government has the power to compel citizens to do virtually anything. Eat your broccoli. A report for mandatory inspection can become a government mandate enforced by fines and regulated by our friends at the IRS. No Twinkies for you. Oh, yeah. And get ready for your colonoscopy administered by the friendly folks over at the DMV. Wow, Russ, that's quite a way to state it, but I think he makes a pretty good point. Now, Larry, by email, says, Bob loved your article on Obama's Supreme Court comments. Although I couldn't locate the 2009 document, it's probably been deleted by now, from Congress's own Congressional Research Service, their in-house legal advisory group submitted a legal opinion to Congress when Obamacare was just being discussed that the individual mandate was almost certainly unconstitutional. The opinion specifically mentioned that such a mandate was an unprecedented expansion of the Commerce Clause from economic trade business activity to inactivity. Commerce Clause jurisprudence had historically applied exclusively to interstate economic activity and was wholly inapplicable to the lack of activity. So even Congress knew or should have known in advance of the slippery slope upon which Obamacare rests. Recall Nancy Pelosi's outrageously ignorant comment when questioned about Obamacare's constitutionality during the deliberations thereon. She said, unconstitutional, are you kidding? Or something to that effect. On the same subject, Peter says, Obama is a complete fraud, a screaming socialist who tramples the Constitution with glee. I have a whole string of expletives that I would love to spout on Obama, but I will spare your Christian eyes from reading them. Well, now Peter has written and phoned our show before. He is a sincere skeptic as regards Christianity, but we do seem to be on the same page politically as far as certain values are concerned. I'm glad he refrained from the expletives, though. We don't need those. We can make our point without them. However, it is always good to hear from you, Peter. Well, one of the perks to doing a radio show is the interesting people I get to meet, but I'm not sure I've ever had a guest who lives a life as fascinating as Henry Bernacki, and I will be introducing him when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Good to be back with you today. Let me introduce my guest. Henry Bernacki is a world explorer, author, pilot, and speaker. He's traveled over 120 countries, North Korea being a recent one. I don't think he witnessed that little launch they did a couple of days ago, but he was in North Korea recently. Mr. Bernacki holds a BA in Romance Languages, French and Spanish, and International Affairs. In high school, he was a four-sport letterman, whittling it down to only two sports in college. He has lived in France, Germany, Taiwan, the West Indies, and Mexico before returning to the United States. He began traveling at 17 years of age when he took the bus from Colorado to Mexico. He is now 39. That sounds like a lot of living for a mere 39 years old. Today, Henry is a captain for one of the top airlines in the USA. I believe that's Virgin Airlines, but he can correct me if that's mistaken. Henry Bernacki's first novel, called No More Heroes, is available now. It's a sensitive story educating and entertaining audiences worldwide. Henry Bernacki has written and been quoted in numerous publications and appeared on many radio shows, including The Travel Guys, Around the World Radio, VacationStationMagazine.com, TravelChannel.com, ChampagneSundaysMagazine.com, Big Blend Radio. There are many, many more, but if I listed them all, we'd never have time to actually interview Henry. Henry Bernacki, welcome to our program.
Hey there, how are you doing, sir, on this pleasant, wonderful Sunday?
It is a wonderful Sunday, and thank you for the promotion by calling me sir, but please feel free to call me Bob. I'm delighted to have you.
I will then.
Henry, you call yourself a traveler first, and then a writer, and then a pilot.
I do. Well, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. That was quite kind of you, and for allowing me to come on your show by responding to Steve Schneikert. I appreciate it. And yes, I think you hit it first. I am a traveler, and because of the way I travel, I think that is my work. And allowing me to get away from that and writing, flying becomes almost a hobby, but I'm not sure. Sometimes they interchange with which is work and which is not, depending on the day, but most of it is traveling.
Yes, and I imagine then being a pilot is kind of your bread and butter. That's how you make a living, but then there's so many other things you've incorporated into your job that, yeah, you're not sure anymore which is the hobby and which is the real job.
Yes, and that's the good thing about, I believe, flying. You do have to study continuously every 6 months to get requalified, and if you don't pass your test, you lose your job. But to me, it is a form of relaxation on learning how to be a safer pilot, and it allows me to escape the kind of vagabond life that traveling is. I just don't even know where I'm going most of the time. I go to the airport and I pick a destination by looking at the departure board. And
okay, now that's interesting. Flying. Can I stop you right there? I always thought that you're a commercial pilot, but you don't know. Yeah. You get to pick your own destination. I always thought destinations were assigned to pilots.
Oh, okay. Well, when I'm traveling as a traveler, I don't know where I'm going. But as a pilot, when I'm actually, yes, I'm a Virgin America captain in the United States.
Oh, I see. And so there's just as many times when you go traveling just as a passenger.
Yes.
Of all the different countries you've been to, what would be the breakdown? How many did you go to as a pilot as opposed to how many you went to as a passenger?
As a passenger, I've been to probably more than 100, believe it or not. And I think that's why I got into flying. It allowed me to travel, whereas before I was paying for traveling and I figured out how to do it. And I had to go to classes for that, and it took years and years. But I managed to do it and follow a path that I guess escaped some people. But I slept in a van through flight school and just made sure I was going to do something that would allow me the freedom to travel continuously throughout my life.
That is really interesting. So now when you travel, then you go to an airport and you just look at the board, and if a destination jumps out at you and you just get this rush and say, I've never been there before, then you just go ahead and step on that plane?
Yes, and just to clarify, I didn't want to confuse you or the listeners, that as a pilot, when I am an airline pilot, I have my schedule set. And
right.
So I know where I'm
right.
going. But as a traveler, I literally will go to, I can go to San Francisco, New York City, Atlanta, and I'll just go to a departure board. And as long as the country does not require a visa to enter, I can literally get on an airplane and take off and go there. Not as a pilot, but I'm going to go there as a passenger and then get off and travel.
That is amazing. You know, it's kind of funny because I've never flown a plane in my life. I fly a lot because I travel a lot. But sometimes on a day off, I find it more restful. I haven't been around the world like you, but I find it more restful to not know where I'm going. I'll sometimes hop in the car and just drive up the coast or drive up in the mountains. And I find it very restful to take off. And it's more of an adventure to not know where I'm actually going to end up. I think that's, of course, just a microcosm, but on a much grander scale, it seems like you're doing something very similar to that.
I think so. It very much is. And it's all relative on the grander scale. But to me, it's everything's a step away in life. If you choose it, just take a step towards something. And it often works out because you're doing something that you want to do. And so you find ways to do it and find find answers to have that accomplished by just going out and doing something. And no matter if you're driving somewhere, taking a bus or anything, I think on my days off, that's what I would like to see me adapting to what the world or the given environment that's around me, I'm adapting myself to whatever it is throwing at me.
I think you must be the freest man I've ever met.
Yeah, I will say back in 97, I went around the world sleeping in the streets and I spent $3,700 that 1 year. And I decided after that time that every decision I could make for the future would allow me, would it be aggregating to more freedom or less freedom? And that's how I live my life to these day, to this day. And the forthcoming days in the future is which gives me more freedom to do what I would like to do in life.
Now, when you were sleeping in the streets, I know most people think of that as a bad thing. Were you enjoying it, sleeping in the streets?
Did you view it as
like the beginning of your adventure of not knowing where you were going to end up? Or
I think indirectly it was only because I had so much student loans and I had some money to pay back, a lot actually. And then I had some money saved and I asked my parents, just pay this amount monthly while I'm traveling. And I had $3,700 to travel with for, for a period of time that it wasn't really an issue for me. But I had $3,700. The rest I had to go towards student loans. So at that time, the only reason I did it is because I had no money.
Oh, okay.
Believe it or not. It wasn't that I was looking for enjoyment or trying to find a different way of living.
No,
it was that.
You happened on that circumstance, but then when it finally happened to you, it sounds like you still saw it as kind of an adventure. You didn't choose it, but it sounds like when it happened to you, there was a part of it you were enjoying, or am I misunderstanding you?
No, I definitely... I'm very disciplined in my life, but at that time, I just learned to step away from what I wanted to do and just kind of adapt. And that's really what it was. I truly did enjoy it.
Okay, that is interesting. Wow.
It was a blessing in disguise that I had no money to go traveling, yet I still wanted to travel and figured out a way to travel.
Now, you say here on your website, and I found this interesting, the way I travel is far more difficult than flying since I never know where I am going. Flying allows me this balance between an unstructured world and a very structured world. Can you expound on that?
Yes. It is, as a traveler now, by not having any money when I was younger, I learned to just go with the flow and enjoy it and not worry about where I was going. And the only time I actually had to know where I was going is when I went into North Korea. It took a year and a half, and they pretty much dictated what I did and what I saw daily. But that's been the only time I've ever really had to follow an itinerary as a traveler. But as an airline pilot, there's so much structure, which I enjoy, the balance, because otherwise, if I didn't have structure, I probably wouldn't be talking to you right now. I'd be in the mountains somewhere just hiking up the Nepali Himalayas somewhere.
Right.
But it is a balance, and I do seek that freedom, but I do know that a modern human, we have bills, we have responsibilities, so to speak, and the flying allows me to get back into a logical world, a structured world, where I do have to answer to somebody. And otherwise, I really would be free-flowing and probably a vagabond continuously. And so the delicate balance between that and flying and making sure the airplane is safe and the people go from A to B in a safe manner is something that I truly enjoy now.
That's interesting. So even when you're going from unstructured to structured, which would be piloting, you're still flying around the world. So as structured as your life gets, it's still a pretty exciting life. There's still an adrenaline rush wherever you go.
Exactly. Yes. And that's why when weather happens and there's delays, I don't really mind it. I don't mind talking to the passengers and explaining more in depth on what is going on, because most people want to know, and too much information for them, I think, is good, so now they can be at ease. Most people don't want that unstructured life. They're taught or trained, whichever it is, that, and I can understand that because I was basically that way too, and so they want to understand why there's a delay. So I'll go out and talk to the passengers. I don't really mind, and so I enjoy it when there's delays. So it's like a puzzle that we have to put together with dispatchers, the in-flight, the other pilot that's in the cockpit. So there's all this, I guess, all this information coming to you, and you have to prioritize what you want to do and make sure that ultimately there is a safe flight.
Now, Henry, when I think of the kind of lifestyle you have, three words jump to my mind, and maybe different words jump to your mind, but three jump to my mind. Freedom, which we've already mentioned, adventure, which we've already mentioned, and then learning. Obviously, you must be learning fascinating things. Of those three words, which do you resonate with the most, or would it be all three together?
I would probably say the learning as well as freedom would be the top two. I mean, they all resonate really deeply within me, but the learning curve that you go through when you step out of the comfort zone of your own home and your own country and then come back to your country, you're constantly adapting to what the societies and other cultures are throwing at you and the people. And that's what is truly amazing, is that I'm constantly feeding my mind and my, I guess, my whole existence with this information, and that hopefully will lead to wisdom. But it is that learning curve that's quite steep when I go into a place that I've never been to, and I take the local transport, the bus, the trains, and you're forced to step outside of yourself. And to me, that is a certain amount of freedom because I've allowed myself to go. So I think those two go hand in hand.
What would you say that you know as a human being now as a result of your traveling that you didn't know when you were a younger man before you started the traveling?
It's all right not to know something.
Oh, kind of the more I learn, the more I realize how little I know, that kind of thing?
It really is. I remember going to like 20 countries at 24 and I felt, oh, I'm seeing a good portion of the world. Then I got to 80 and I was like, wow, this, I feel like I'm just beginning. And then when I went over 100, I realized that I'm just a novice. I'm just a naive kind of silly guy just vagabonding around. And that's what it really is, that not knowing an answer, not knowing or looking silly in front of some people, well, we don't know everything, and the only way you learn is through that asking of people that do know, and not knowing where to go as well, not having a destination. So it's that, I would say that not knowing, have it be a circumstance, where to go in a city, or not knowing the answer or where to go and is the outcome, is something I've learned.
Yeah, you know, when I was in my 20s, I knew everything. I'm in my late 50s now, and I don't know nearly as much as I thought I knew when I was 20. Life can do that to us, can't it?
It humbles you.
It does. I mean, yeah, you're... Now, I just have to ask this, and I'm guessing that maybe you've done this, but or maybe I'll be the first one to ask you. I don't know. Have you gotten out a globe or an atlas or done an internet search and made a list of every single country you have not been to yet?
No, I haven't. I do have a map of the world that I had laminated. I keep in our guest bedroom that if people come and visit, they sleep in the guest bedroom. So that's quite nice. They could see the world map and hopefully go out and enjoy the world as well. And I have lines that I've flown to as a pilot and or a passenger.
I've got this picture of the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark in my head right now, and I'm seeing the plane take off with the little arrow going across the map with the dun-dun-dun-dun.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my goodness. This is fascinating. Okay, now, I'm sure you've probably been asked this a million times till you're tired of it, but do you have a family? And if so, how does the traveling work out regarding your family? Do you have a wife and children, or are you single? Or
No wife, no kids. I have... a mom and dad that live in Colorado and four older sisters, believe it or not. And one sister is in Scotland and the other three are in Colorado. And I have a bunch of nephew and nieces. So I think that's my family there, is I get to watch my nephews and nieces grow up, which is wonderful.
Okay. Now, if this is too personal, don't feel obligated to answer. But did you decide not to get married because you want to travel, or is it because there were other reasons you decided to not get married and therefore you're free to travel? I guess I'm asking which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, exactly. I definitely think that the person that somebody's with this kind of lifestyle is a mature partner that has to understand that's within the person's inner core is that learning, that traveling bug, and that wants to go out and learn. And so I think that's probably the primary of... for me. So the person always has to understand if there's a dire need to go out and see the world or whatever it is that calling is. Mm-hmm. And mine truly is traveling. I definitely want to go out and see more and more of the world. And I've been like this since I was 8 years old.
Wow. And what was your very first vacation when you were 8? What was the first place your parents ever took you to that put the traveling bug into you?
Well, I lived in Pennsylvania, and my mom every summer would put me on an airplane.
Really?
And send me
by yourself?
Yes, by myself.
So that's
and
how you got so used to
sisters.
Wow, so you got used to being by yourself pretty early on in life then.
Yes, I was always I would go up and say hello to the pilots, and I had no idea that I was going to fly at that age. I just wanted to explore.
Uh-huh. Are you a fan of the movie Airplane? Do you like that?
Yeah,
that
I like it. You know, I just seen it probably about 5 years ago for the first time.
Oh, really? Really? Okay. Yeah.
But I think back at that age when going to Nebraska to visit my uncles and my grandfather, that it was inside of me to begin traveling at that age. And it was not very difficult. It was just you go on an airplane and you sit there and you enjoy the takeoff and landing. And I remember it very as if it was yesterday.
So are there ever times where you feel lonesome traveling alone, or are you meeting so many fascinating new people that that's where you're getting your connections with people?
I travel alone 90% of the time. 90% of the time I travel alone, but oftentimes I'll travel. Lately I've been going with a buddy of mine, and before that, I just, for some reason, people don't have the freedom that I have, and so it's quite difficult to get time off the work schedule, and so I usually go alone. And where I go these days, most people don't want to. They don't want to go visit North Korea.
Yeah, you know, I can see that. Disney World, North Korea. Disney World, North Korea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll bring back a story, and maybe they'll read about it and say, okay, that's not for me.
Can you think of any country in the world where you're going, boy, that's one place I don't care to go, or would you be willing to go absolutely anywhere?
And great question, and I often think about that because when I lived in France and went to university there, I thought, oh, I want to go to these certain places. But when I went there, I had a preconceived notion already in my head. And I realized when I didn't have those preconceived notions, the best experience often was formulating in front of me, maybe because I was adapting to it and I just didn't care what was going on. But if I wanted to go see a country, and if I do want to go see a country, I do not go now. I've actually was on a loading bridge going to Portugal one time, and I turned around and walked off because I wanted to go there. And now I go to countries that I don't want to go to. I know it sounds bizarre.
Is it because you're feeling like, boy, this is reminding me of an episode of Seinfeld where George Costanza did the opposite of all his impulses and great things happen. Are you feeling like if you go opposite your impulse, then there's some very pleasant surprise that you wouldn't have found otherwise?
Exactly. I think it's that preconceived notion. I have an experience already in my head, maybe because somebody talked about it or whatever it may be. And then I will have this outcome already playing out. Whereas if I don't want to go to a place, if say Dakar, Senegal, and it's not really high on my list, but I'm going to go there because that is not high on my list. And I know it'll be a good outcome because I'm not expecting anything. The expectations when you travel are pretty much what...
Are you there, Henry?
Upset people.
Okay, Henry, I think we're starting to lose you. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, I just suddenly heard some static. Boy, I don't think you're in a plane right now. It sounded like a plane was about.
No, and I think, sorry about that.
That's okay.
The expectations are what I try to get away from when I do travel. And by going off to countries that I'm not really looking at, and I don't ever know where I'm staying either. I don't read a guidebook. The only thing I have to know is, do I need a visa to enter the country? And beyond that, it really is something I just go and wing. And it's a lot of trust, and it's an art on how you travel and how you go about it. But it is quite difficult to grasp. But once you just kind of let it go, there's nothing really big that can happen. You just kind of go, okay, I'm not going to travel with anything I don't mind getting stolen, because I think everything will get stolen. So...
Well, you've certainly picked up a lot of wisdom along the way. It's almost as if your traveling is your whole metaphor for life itself.
Exactly. It really pretty much is. It's outlining it, and have it be other people doing it for me because they think I should go to a certain spot and they drive me there or guide me there. I let things that I can't control go ahead and just kind of guide me. The things in my control are my attitude towards these things. And that's what I try to have, a really great attitude, so it's the learning comes a lot easier.
It's interesting what you're saying about expectations, because I think much of the disappointment we have in life as human beings is when things don't happen as quickly as we want, or that we're expecting our lives to go a certain way at all. And it sounds like, in a way, you've just kind of thrown yourself to the wind. And I'm saying this in a positive way. I'm saying this as a compliment. And you're just saying, okay, wherever life takes me, I'm prepared to go there. If I have an expectation of how it should be, then I'm only setting myself up for disappointment. But if I have zero expectations, I'm setting myself up for a learning experience and some pleasure that will surprise me. Sometimes pleasure has to surprise us. We can't plan it. We can't chart it out. Is that?
It really very much is that way. I remember flying with a guy, Patrick Dote. He lives in Boise, and he was like, hey, I mean this as a positive. You might take it as a negative, but you don't have any goals, and that's what's great. And it's a fine line, and I think when you're younger, you have those goals and that building the foundation on discipline, and I had that through sports. And to this day, I try to not be so focused on that destination, because I can miss a wonderful path that I turn left or right or go backwards and forwards. It doesn't really matter. And it truly is that way for me now, that I find the best experiences by just throwing something out there. And along the way, something's pushing me around. And I don't mind that. I am adapting to it, and I'm going along with it. And the thing I can control is my attitude. The outcome of a situation I can't always control. And if I don't like the outcome, it's like a broom pushing or sweeping up the floor in your kitchen. And the dust, we can't control where it settles, but we can sweep it up again. That's been my philosophy for a long time. So if you want to look at it this way, God controls that dust settling, and we're there to kick it up again if we don't like where it settles, if that makes a lot of sense.
You know, it does. Now, you mentioned you were in four different sports in high school, cut it down to two in college. Now, sports is very regimented, very disciplined. So is being a pilot, as you said. Some would look at a life like yours and say it's so carefree, it's not disciplined. It looks to me like it's a very unique combination of discipline and freedom working in harmony.
Yeah, again, it's that balance of what it is to be disciplined and not disciplined. And as sports are, you wake up, you train, but in the match and wrestling or football or baseball, you're adapting continuously to the outside circumstances of somebody throwing the ball, running at you, you got to tackle the person, or in wrestling, take down. You're adapting continuously every second. A pitch thrown, you have to adapt with your bat. And so you prepare yourself in sports for situations. The outcome of these situations are yet to be defined. You have to go through the process, which is like life. And I've allowed myself, and I've been able to do it by allowing that balance. It is subtle. And you have to be very respectful of that balance, because it could be taken away, that freedom, in a moment if you're not prepared for that.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Henry Bernacki, a travel writer, a pilot. He's been to almost 200 different countries. One of the things Henry wrote that I really like: traveling has taught me how simple life can be. I write for the people with whom I am able to meet while I am on the road. I write in fiction so that I am not the focal point of any novel, article, or piece I do. I want the focus to be on the people and places about which I am writing. Flying has permitted me access to the furthermost reaches of this world without worrying about how to arrive at my destination. I concentrate on the journey and what it means to be going. That's a very fascinating way to say things, Henry.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Coming from you, especially, you hear a lot of people speak, and you read a lot of books and novels and articles, and so by you saying that, I truly appreciate that. But honestly, it comes from sitting down and not rushing through a country or a city. It comes from sitting down and speaking to people like you and making sure I respect that exact moment, not letting it disappear.
Now, you met Mother Teresa 3 days before she died, and you spoke with her over breakfast. In your interview with Mother Teresa, you wrote at the beginning of it, of your piece, her soul outgrew her fragile body. Her eyes grew with intensity the more we gazed at one another and spoke. Her touch was soft as I bent over for her to bless me on my forehead, handing me 2 medals of the Virgin Mary. Mother Teresa sat in her wheelchair on the second floor of Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta, India, greeting the 10 people who came to see her that September morning in 1997. Well, first of all, you write very well. I mean, that's excellent writing. Now, you mentioned earlier a little bit, you mentioned some kind of faith in God regarding God controls where the dust goes. Are you of Catholic persuasion? Or
I'm Catholic.
You were raised Catholic? Now, were you just raised Catholic, or do you still consider yourself to be a devout Catholic?
I go to Mass.
Okay.
I go to Mass every Sunday. I'm home. And if I'm not flying, then I go to Mass, yes. And so, I mean, is that devout? I guess. I mean, I really, if people have a faith, to me these days, because it's about faith, if they have a higher being they believe in, that's great. A lot of people just allow this freedom of, oh, I don't need to believe in God or a higher being. But as long as somebody believes in something, I really don't mind what it is. But for me, I am Catholic and raised. At 12 years old, I was baptized a Catholic.
Okay, now that's interesting because most Catholics are baptized as babies. Did your parents convert to Catholicism farther along the road? Usually it's babies baptized and then they get confirmed when they're 12.
Exactly.
You made a choice to become a Catholic?
Yes, I was.
Wow.
My mom, she was remarried when I was 12. And before that, we lived in Pennsylvania on the Ohio-Pennsylvania border of Erie. And my godmother was a nun. And so after school, I would go to the convent and they would be my babysitters, believe it or not. And so my mom, with one of the nuns, she would carpool with her. And Sister Marsh Marie was her name. And she said, oh, you know, if you'd like to have your kids baptized, we can have that happen. And like a couple years later, I was baptized a Catholic. And so it just happened to be that. And my grandfather was a Russian Jew descent. And so becoming from that to Catholicism was, to me, I was so young that I was always around the nuns in the convent that it was, that's why being around Mother Teresa was quite normal. I was basically back when I was young again.
Well, we have a little bit in common. Both of my grandfathers were Jewish, and both of them came from Russia. And I converted to Christianity, not at 12, but in college, more the Protestant variety. But when you met Mother Teresa then, it wasn't just another fascinating place to visit, and it wasn't just another well-known person, but being a Catholic, it must have just been a double thrill for you.
It was. I ended up in Calcutta, India, not knowing she was even there. I talked to a British guy, and he goes, yeah, I was just visiting with Mother Teresa today. And I was like, you can just go up there and meet her? He's like, yeah, go tomorrow morning at 5 in the morning, go to Mass, and then you can have breakfast with her. And I was like, no way.
But you mean she was that approachable easy. That anybody could just sit down and have breakfast with her?
Yes, you could have Mass with her. And then Sister Nirmala would say, come back at 10 in the morning and have breakfast after Mass because she would like to rest. And it was... That's how I honestly travel now, and I'm glad I listened to my inner core at that time. This guy was like, oh, just go here, and you'll meet her. And it literally was. I knocked on the door of Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta in 1997, and it took about 15 minutes for them to open the door, but they finally did. And I walked up, sat in Mass, and she was probably 20 feet from me at that time. And that was the year I was sleeping on the streets for a year. And there were things that were occurring around me at that time that I was like, yeah, this is normal. I'm supposed to be meeting Mother Teresa now. And I did. And like I had said in that article about Mother Teresa, her soul truly did explode out of her body. It just was radiating out of her body through her eyes. She would look at you with an intense calmness that she was grabbing you with her eyes and hugging you without even touching you.
Wow, and what an act of providence that you saw her just a few days from her. Was her death impending? I don't remember. Did she know she was going to die soon, or was it a surprise?
It was a surprise, and I asked her how she was feeling when we were having breakfast together, and she said fine. And most of the things, she wanted to ask why I was traveling so far from home. And at that, my response it probably was, home now is where I'm going to sleep right now.
Wow.
It was the world.
So did you go to India just by stepping on a plane and choosing at the last minute, or were you piloting to India?
No, I was not even a pilot at that time.
Wow. Well, listen, Henry, we are out of time, but look, you are a great guy and a fascinating guy, and I wish you would start piloting planes without knowing where you're going, because I'd like to get on one of them. I think it would be a blast. Listen, I hope you will do us the honor of coming on our show again sometime.
I look forward to it.
Okay, I didn't get much of a chance to tell people about it, but your novel, No More Heroes, can they find that on Amazon.com?
Amazon, Yahoo, Amazon, the Nook, the Kindle, the e-readers, all that, and
okay.
Barnes & Noble as well.
No More Heroes by Henry Bernacki. Henry, thank you so much. It was terrific having you. I will see you next week, everybody. Bob. Next week, I'm debating another atheist. Should be fun. Come and join us. We'll see ya.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.